From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, voting in the time of coronavirus, will it be done by mail, and what will that look like? How the post office is a critical lifeline for rural Texas, and how nonprofits across the nation are struggling to keep up. This is Texas Matters. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. This week, a Texas judge said he will clarify that voters fearful of contracting COVID-19 will be allowed to use mail-in ballots during the elections in July and November. This counters what Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton announced in a press release, which claimed fear of contracting the coronavirus does not count for Texans applying to vote by mail. If the Travis County District Court judge's order is upheld, Paxton will be overruled, and all of the state's approximately 16 million registered voters will be eligible to apply for an absentee ballot. Texas has one of the strictest vote-by-mail programs in the country. Currently, only people over 65, people who are in jail, people who will be out of the county, and those who are sick or disabled can get a mail-in ballot. President Trump has said that he opposes expansion of mail-in voting. Trump and his supporters are now spreading misinformation about mail-in voting. The Brenham Center for Justice is touting mail-in ballots this election cycle as necessary to protect the public and poll workers from the spread of coronavirus. Mirna Perez is the Director of Voting Rights and Elections Program at the Brenham Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law.
Many Americans have been voting by mail for quite some time. In fact, there are a handful of states where their elections are conducted almost entirely by mail. And every state, including Texas, has some options for voters to be able to cast a ballot via mail.
The Brenham Center did do a survey and found out that there's a strong majority of Americans, including 57% of Republicans, that want the opportunity to safely cast a vote by mail without having to wait for long lines or crowds.
Certainly, we are at a particular moment in time. We are facing an international pandemic, and folks want to both exercise their fundamental right to vote and keep them and their families and loved ones safe and healthy. And part of the way that our country will allow both of those to happen has to include vote by mail options.
Unfortunately, that is not an automatic kind of a thing that just happens, because some people say this is smart. This keeps people safe. This is a way we can actually expand who gets to vote in some instances. There's a struggle in order to make this actually happen, and we're seeing that in Texas. But also in this process, we're seeing some people push a false narrative about vote by mail. What does the Brenham Center want people to know about vote by mail?
We are at a particular moment in time in which voters are going to need options in order to be able to make the decision about what is the smartest and safest way for them to be able to cast a ballot. Some voters will want to vote by mail. Other voters will want in-person voting options. And given the crisis that our country is facing, we need to make sure that voters have all of the options available, because we are going to need the benefit of all of our citizens weighing in on the direction of the country. And people should not have to be choosing between their safety and their health and their fundamental right to vote. I find it really unusual that, given the time that we are in now, given the crisis, we're actually hearing some people try to constrict options. That's exactly the wrong time to be limiting the ways in which people can participate. It's precisely in these kinds of crises that we need to be creative and afford voters more choices about how they want to participate.
In Texas, we have voter ID. That's a requirement to vote. Produce your state-issued photo ID in order to cast your ballot. Do you have to remove your mask in order to be ID'd to make sure that you are actually the person who is in that on that ID?
So First of all, I'm from Texas. I don't know if your listeners know that I'm from San Antonio. Also one of the litigators in the Texas photo ID case. And I can tell you that that photo ID law did not contemplate the kind of scenario that we're experiencing now, which is one in which people are under shelter at home instructions. People are required or advised strongly to be 6 feet away from each other, where Department of Motor Vehicles are closed and people can't be getting IDs. So what my takeaway from all of that is that we are in a very unique moment that's going to require some creativity and common sense on the part of our elected officials and on the part of our election administrators to be able to get through this crisis in a way that protects our fundamental right to vote and keeps people safe. And again, that is going to mean looking to what states, what options are available in other states, and applying those lessons from those other states to what we do in Texas. It's very frustrating for people to act like a vote by mail option is something that was like brand new and invented. Voters have familiarity with it. States have familiarity with it. Expanding it so that it became a realistic option for all voters is definitely going to take resources and a lot of planning. But they do have lessons and models within states and outside of their own state.
How do you do voter identity verification with mail-in ballots?
Different states do it in different ways. Some of the states that really rely on vote by mail as their overwhelming way in which they conduct their elections have a series of steps. So one of the steps might include what sometimes people call an IMB or an intelligent mail barcode, so that at every point in the vote by mail pipeline, a ballot is being tracked. So you can see a chain of custody, you can see who had it. If it goes missing, you know where. If it stayed too long in a particular place, that raises suspicion, you'll be able to know that. It's also really good for letting voters know where their ballot is in the process. A number of states have checking personal identifying information, verifying that the information that is provided on the mail ballot is consistent with the ballot, with the information that the voter provided when they registered. Some states use comparisons of signature and other affirmation mechanisms. So there's a number of ways in which this can be done smartly and intelligently. And what I hope is the big takeaway for your listeners is that we are in a very unique moment in time that requires us to look at different ways of doing business because we are experiencing something very new. And as such, we cannot be conducting business as usual. It doesn't work now. Nothing else has stayed the same. All of our lives have been disrupted in major ways, and all of us are having to undergo a number of changes in our day-to-day life, and voting is not going to be accepted.
How long does it usually take to get results from a vote-in-mail election?
It depends on the state. It depends on how many people they have to process the mail ballots. It depends on whether or not they when they require receipt of the ballot. It depends on when their certification deadlines are. I do think it is reasonable to presume, and people should start having their expectations managed, that we may not find out at the end of election day who was the winner in any particular race, because ballots will still be coming in and because there's going to be a shortage of election workers. But there's no one prediction. It's a dynamic number, or it's a dynamic prediction that's going to depend upon how many poll workers to process it people have and what other deadlines they have set.
Voting by mail depends upon having a mail system. We know that the post office is needs some money from the federal government right now. Reluctance, to put it mildly, coming from the Trump administration to support the postal system. Some are saying if it doesn't get enough money in the next couple of months, it could just collapse. I don't know why that's happening, and I don't want to speculate. We need to have a postal system to do mail-in ballots, I guess?
We do, but I do think that the concern about mail delivery under any circumstances, again, speaks to the need of risk diversification and therefore in-person polling place options. Before the coronavirus, there were some communities that could not and cannot reliably depend upon the mail. Some very rural areas, some very dense urban areas. If you live in a big high rise in New York, you may not be getting good mail. If you live on an Indian reservation in an Indian territory, you're not going to get, you're not going to be guaranteed a good, reliable mail. And moreover, you have members of our communities who have visual or physical impairments. And in order to be able to cast a secure and independent ballot, they are going to need the assistance of the technology that right now only exists at polling places. So there are a number of reasons, including the concern over the future of the post office, that we want to maintain meaningful in-person polling place options.
There are people who will attack the results of the election, particularly if they get voted out of office, and they'll say it's not legitimate because it was done all by mail. And what would be the proper response to someone who would probably say that?
I think legitimacy is a loaded word. I think it is imprecise and can be used in a bunch of different ways. I mean, I would...
Which is why a lot of people use it.
Right. I would ask the question, was it free? Was it fair? Was it accessible? And was it accurate or secure? Depending on the words that you want to use. And if the answers to those questions are yes, then I think we can feel good about the election that took place. I think elections are incredibly important. They're the ways we resolve political differences. They're the ways that we set the direction of the country. And that is why our politicians need to be working really, really hard to find ways in which all of us are able to participate.
Mirna Perez is the Director of Voting Rights and Elections Program at the Brenham Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. They are giving mail-in voting their stamp of approval. Without a fully functioning post office system, it would be difficult at best to have a mail-in election, and the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S. has plunged the Postal Service into a dire financial situation, as more Americans than ever are relying on the post office to deliver necessary medicine and supplies, especially in underserved rural areas. The Washington Post has reported that President Donald Trump is opposed to any measures to help the post office, and he refused to sign the CARES Act stimulus package if it included a bailout for the agency. John McHugh is the director of a group that is called John McHugh is the chairman of a group that is calling for support for the post office. They are named the Package Coalition.
Well, it's a group of more than 20 brands and companies, some of the best-known brands and companies in America, National Retail Federation, Pitney Bowes, Amazon, that came together about a year ago, really over concern of artificial non-market-based price increases to packages. As we know, and as we're particularly aware of right now in this time of pandemic, the Postal Service package deliveries are absolutely essential to the economy, and now it turns out the health and welfare of Americans across the country, but particularly those in rural and underserved locations, and to just by fiat on a non-market basis compel price increases is just not good policy. And we're concerned about that, and we're trying to help the public and a broader band of members of Congress to best understand that.
John McHugh is the chairman of the Package Coalition, which is calling on President Trump to support the post office. If the post office were to stop functioning, he says it would be rural areas hit the hardest. Charitable organizations are a critical part of the social safety net in the United States, providing food, shelter, and cash assistance to vulnerable people who fall through the gaps. And in the time of COVID-19, those gaps are growing larger and larger every day. There is an unprecedented demand for their services, and social service nonprofits are struggling to keep up. Jamie Dowdell is a Reuters reporter, and she took a deep dive looking at how nonprofits are being leaned on like never before.
Obviously, this crisis has impacted everyone on some level, whether it's illness, if you know they're having trouble with childcare, or lost income. So there's a lot of need in many ways. But what we wanted to look at, what we've been looking at, are some of the most basic needs, those being food, shelter, financial support, you know, for people that need to pay rent, keep the utilities, keep the lights on. And so we've been calling this the social safety net as we've been working through it. And these duties to provide those basic things often fall to nonprofits in our country. And they're the ones that help the vulnerable and those that need it most. And so we spent the past couple of weeks talking to folks who work at these kind of nonprofits, and they're, you know, food banks, homeless shelters, shelters for victims of family and domestic violence. And, you know, what's interesting is they're in just about every community, especially larger cities. And they're doing the same kind of thing that they always do, provide meals, shelter, protection, assistance, but now they're being asked to do it more than ever before. And so it's really interesting to see how, you know, these nonprofits are having to change the way they do things on the fly, you know, just like all of us. And at the same time, they're also being stressed in many unique ways.
They're caught in the middle of a food bank sandwich where one side of it is increased need. People are coming to the food bank who have never actually been to the food bank before. Maybe they've been there to drop off food, and now here they've lost their jobs and they're turning to the food bank for support. Also, where the food bank usually could get support, that has dried up as well. And this is not just for food banks, but it's for almost all nonprofits. What's it look like moving forward?
Well, you know, exactly. And, you know, the kinds of things that they're dealing with. And I think it's interesting that you called it the sandwich, right? So they've got the need, and then they've got this lack of resources really is what's happening. And so, you know, all these people that they're helping are in crisis, but the nonprofits themselves are in crisis. And what's, you know, all of the nonprofits I spoke with, they're, you know, they're just like the rest of us right now. We're tired, we're stressed, and they're focused on the moment and just doing, you know, providing their mission, okay? Providing their mission over and over and over again. I was told, you know, we're going to do whatever it takes to not shut our doors. And they have seen this demand just skyrocket, you know, with people in an instant, you know, millions of people losing their jobs, right? They've seen demand skyrocket. And so they've tried to adjust to meet that need. But what's happening is, you know, when you go from, you know, I talked to a food bank in Indianapolis, they usually feed 5,000 households a month, which sounds like a lot, but they're on pace this month to feed 18,000 households. So that wasn't in the budget at all. And so they're trying to meet this demand without have ever thought that they would need this type of funding. And so while they're adjusting and meeting the need right now, one of the concerns is what's next, what's down the road? How long can we keep this up? What kind of support do we need? And, you know, we started with this, looking at nonprofits, you know, having conversations with leaders, and it really became clear that we wanted to get a better sense of what's really going on and how they're going to be impacted and whether or not they're actually going to maintain this. And so we partnered with Charity Navigator, to do a survey, right? I work a lot with data, and so we wanted to actually get data on this. So Charity Navigator is itself a organization, a nonprofit, and they exist to be a watchdog of nonprofits, and they rate charities. And so they typically, there's some sort of threshold that's tends to be larger nonprofits with a certain budget, and they rate them on different things such as transparency, those types of things. And so their act is like a watchdog. I asked them for some data because what I wanted was to get a sense of these social service nonprofits, you know, the key frontline nonprofits that are getting hammered right now. And we decided that it was, we were, you know, both Charity Navigator and Reuters were interested in learning more. So we conducted a survey, and it was really interesting. We found that, so 150 nonprofits, that serve social service needs, responded to the survey, and more than 75% of those reported that they had suffered financially. And so those financial hits come in many forms. Canceled fundraisers, spring is a big time for fundraisers. So they're counting on, you know, $100,000 here, $50,000 there, and that's not happening. You know, people lost their jobs, so they're not getting the same kind of individual donations as they might have before. And, you know, even nonprofits that I spoke with that went through the Great Recession, and they said, you know, we learned a lot. We diversified our revenue. And so, you know, we're trying to get revenue in different areas. But when everything gets shut down at once, that still doesn't work. So a lot of these nonprofits, maybe they were operating a thrift store or childcare services, and those key program areas were actually needed to support some of the things like giving food, right? And so they had suffered financially. At the same time, those same nonprofits, 60% have seen an increase in demand for services. So that's 60% of the 150. And they're suffering in as well. So nearly half of the 150 told us they couldn't get enough volunteers. And a lot of these nonprofits operate on a model that mobilizes people in the community to help them. But when people are told to stay home and, you know, protect them, rightfully so, that stops that line of help. Meanwhile, the need isn't stopping. So another major issue, which you mentioned with the food banks, is the supply chain. So all 16 food banks that responded to us, every single one said that they had experienced a disruption in the supply chain. And so what's interesting with that is in the typically operate on a surplus food and donations. That's how they operate. That's how they get their food. And so now not only are they seeing more and more people who they need, but they also have to come up with money to buy food because there's no more donation. So it really is, you know, like they called it a perfect storm.
What about the federal government being able to supply some support? They've passed a $2 trillion CARES Act. Was there room in there for helping nonprofits?
Yeah. So the CARES Act has helped. And, you know, a number of nonprofits have said that, you know, they're very, very happy that happened. Some of the aid in the CARES Act includes access to loans to cover payroll and operating costs. I spoke with one of the nonprofits, was just thrilled that they got the payroll loan. And it also, that CARES Act expands the ability of taxpayers to claim deductions on cash donations made in 2020. And so, you know, nonprofits are helping with that. That being said, there's still, you know, there's still just an extensive amount of need. The number of dollars that these nonprofits need to function is quite impressive. You know, there's one of the food banks I talked to, in the one in Indianapolis, Gleaners, they have estimated that just for the summer months, so we're talking like June, July, and August, they need an additional $5 million to continue demand if to meet the demand if it continues right now. And just, you know, we looked into a number of kind of emergency funds, where emergency funds have been set up for people impacted by the crisis, whether they've lost jobs, caring for loved ones, whatnot. And a number of these emergency funds, you know, just had to close up applications because they just know they don't have enough money to meet that. And the number of applications, there's a nonprofit in San Jose that had raised $11 million with partners in the community for emergency funding. And they opened a application system on March 23rd. And within hours, that system crashed. More than 1,000 people tried to apply. By the time they had 4,500 applications, they shut the system down because they said, there's, you know, like all this money is going to be gone. And so what they did is they opened up what they call an interest list, which is essentially a wait list. But what they're waiting for, the people on this list are waiting for the chance to apply if and when the organization can raise some more funds. And the last I heard, that list of households waiting to meet to just apply, that list is at almost 10,000 households right now. And that's just the type of thing that's being repeated over and over again.
You're reporting on the initial burst when this happened and how people who had some means and abundance are trying to help out and food banks are rising to the challenge. But this is going to be an ongoing issue. The abnormal situation right now is becoming the normal for the time being. Mm-hmm. And it's wondering, like, where were we going to be in 3 months when we're still dealing with an economy that is in some sort of shutdown? People still need jobs, they still need food, they still need to pay rent, and the nonprofits may be tapped out.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that, you know, in our reporting, no one wanted to say that. Basically, the spirit of these nonprofits is we are going to do whatever it takes. And we are going to keep the doors open. And so, you know, it's important to note that there's been a big rallying of support within communities. Corporations have been stepping up. You know, people are still giving. Obviously, the need is more. There's additional help potentially coming from the government. There was a bill introduced on March 27th by Representative Seth Moulton in Massachusetts, and that would provide $60 billion in emergency funding. $60 billion is a number that we've heard a lot, is that that's what nonprofits need to get by. So, you know, there's additional help. I think the nonprofits are trying to figure out how to make this work, but, you know, as they've said, like, there's nothing in our history that we can look back on to inform this, right? And this is unprecedented. The word I've heard over and over and over again, you know, we've heard it for everything. This is unprecedented. It's unprecedented for them. And, you know, they're trying to figure it out as they go too.
Jamie Dowdell is a reporter for Reuters News Agency. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past episodes of Texas Matters, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.